Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a January 8th, 2008 segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. Tonight we have a very distinguished anonymous guest, and he is with us at this time, is he not?
Yes, hi James.
Hello, how are you, anonymous guest?
I'm doing good.
Great, welcome to the show. Now, we should probably explain why it is that people such as yourself, and there are many of you out there, are willing to participate somewhat reluctantly in a show like this, but only if your identity is kept out of the picture. Why is it that there would be people all over the world who have been following alternative energy technology for decades who would not want to be identified publicly? Could you answer that on behalf of all those who are of your number?
The life expectancy of some of the people were probably like a Second World War machine gunner.
That's a good illustration. So in other words, it hasn't necessarily been safe in the past to be an advocate of an actual device that bypasses the current paradigm of selling energy.
Right.
Because energy is the world's biggest business. And if you're stepping on those toes, you're stepping on some pretty big toes. Well, now, why don't we tell people how it is that you got interested in alternative energy? This goes back over 20 years ago, right?
Yes. We picked up a piece of property, and we're going to build our dream house on it, and I thought it would be pretty straightforward. One of the power lines was only a mile down the road. So
this was a rural property?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, our driveway was 3 miles long.
Okay, well, many, many people in the United States have had this experience, and perhaps people in other countries can relate to it also. You have utilities within sight of your property, and you go to the utility and ask for a hookup, and you would think they would be quite happy to have another customer. Is that it?
That's what I thought. But they came out and looked at it and says, well, you can't use that particular line. You'll have to go another 4 miles out and make the connection, and it'll cost you about $80,000 to get property run in. So when you get smacked in the face with that kind of a bill, you start, you know, getting serious about looking at alternatives.
Yeah, and really you could almost say that the situation that we're in right now is similar. It may not be $80,000 in one whack, but people are looking at heating bills that amount to many thousands of dollars for a heating season.
Right.
And they're looking at a bill just to drive to work and back that ends up taking out, in some cases, maybe a week's pay. And so it does cause them to want to look twice at why they're having to spend so much for energy. So
it's, to most, to anybody that's been looking at this, it's, especially like yourselves that has done, actually sees how far back these answers were. You know, granted they weren't, everything wasn't ironed out back, you know, in the 1800s or 1870s, but that was the road that we should have taken to be in a better position than we are today.
But there were already people who were making money on energy way back then. We fail to realize that, perhaps. In our petroleum or petrochemical age, we don't realize that there were coal barons. And even as they say about the buggy whips and whatnot, you know, when the automobile came on the scene, there were vested interests who did not want any kind of self-propelled wagon taking the place of horse and buggy. You know.
Yeah, that's true, I guess, with any change.
Yeah, so but energy has always been a big business. There were so many thousands of tons of coal used every year in almost every town that there was a tremendous amount of income there.
And to enlighten the listeners a little bit, this is not something that is just now being uncovered, like you found out in your research. But what really got to me, because back in this, the time that I became, you know, started seriously looking at alternatives, E.V. Gray was in Southern California. Howard Johnson was there with his magnetic motor. Newman, Wyatt, there were a number of people with technologies that, you know, were addressing the situation. And I just happened upon, I went to one of, what's that guy's name? Dennis Lee's little energy deals, and he mentioned a heat engine. And I looked at it, and to me it made a lot of sense. And I was looking in the Mechanical Engineer's Handbook of 1965. And under the classification of direct energy conversion, it mentioned this heat engine to drive a generator, and the whole unit to put out 12 kW would have weighed 36 pounds. You could have put that in any little closet in your house and produced all the energy you needed.
And using what?
Pardon?
Using what to produce that energy?
That was a heat engine.
How does a heat engine work?
Well, there are a number of different types of heat engine. This one, I believe, might have been the Fisher heat engine.
It takes
water. You efficiently use some form of energy to heat water to its critical point, which is up around just under 800 degrees. And then you get such an expansive amount of energy out of that that it was the most efficient that I was looking at, and I like the size.
So what are you doing? Turning a turbine or something, or?
No, they were using a reciprocating type mechanism, you know, like a piston engine
connected to a generator.
And then yes, connect that to a generator.
Okay, so you're basically sort of like a nuclear power plant. You're using some high-tech means to heat water, huh?
Yeah, but the neat thing about that, the last sentence, it made mention, it says, this could be used to heat all of the hot water, provide all of the heat, and provide all the electricity for schools, businesses, universities, hospitals, businesses, everything.
Now, it said that in this engineering manual that you're referring to?
Yeah, see, every year they spotlight another technology or two, so you're not going to find this in every instance. I believe it was either in 1965 or 1966, Mechanical Engineer's Handbook. But the last sentence said, but this will be used for space and military applications only.
Huh. Now, why would they say that?
Because they're not about to.
I mean, it's not because it was nuclear or something, right?
Right. No, it was safe. I mean, there was, nothing, no radiation, nothing.
And yet they put a disclaimer on it saying that the public doesn't get it.
Right. And that's not the only one. I'll give you another even more recent example. There was a young fellow that went into the Marines. He was out, and I was visiting, and he was telling his grandmother what I thought was a story that he almost got court-martialed and blah blah blah, and it was over a flashlight. And I was jibing him, you know, and I said, the only reason nobody's going to court-martial you for a $2 flashlight, you know, you must have smacked your DI upside the side of the head or something.
Hmm.
And he went on to explain, and his training was in heavy equipment repair, trucks and equipment, and one evening they had called him out to go out and work on a deuce and a half of one of the big trucks. And he checked tools and a flashlight out, and he didn't return the flashlight.
Hmm.
And a week later, the MPs came and told him, you know, no flashlight, you know, you're out of here. And I guess he was sitting in that little brig for a little bit thinking, you know, where I don't have a flashlight, you know, and then it finally dawned on him he had to check one out that evening to go work on the truck. Now, here it is. Remember now, this is a week later. He took them out under armed guard to show them where he was, and they found the flashlight. and the flashlight was still burning bright.
Huh.
I don't have a flashlight like that. You don't have one like that.
But well, that's why they made such an issue of it, huh?
Yeah, and if you look up under, I think it's promethium is the element, you'll see it in the Britannica, mentions it, that's a battery that will put out full energy for 18 years, and then it will just nosedive.
Huh.
But, I mean,
and how did he find out, or did he find out what had actually been the cause of his arrest?
No, that was it, just the flashlight.
But did anyone explain to him?
Oh, no.
Okay, so this is something that you and him figured out on your own?
No, I don't think he ever got it. It dawned, you know, the minute he mentioned that, that it was a week, I says, how long was it then? Oh, it was a week, you know.
So you figured it out.
Yeah, I mean, it just hit me, you know. I don't have a flashlight that'll last that long. I'm good if I can leave mine on for 2 hours.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the technology is out there. I mean, these people have been, you know, if you go back to Dr. Page up in the Northeast, maybe Virginia, somewhere around there, prior to the Civil War, right around that time, the Union soldier sacked his place. You know, we don't want anybody else to have this technology. And he was ahead of Stubblefield, I think, on the earth batteries for, you know, communication, telegraph, and whatnot is what I think he was working on that end for. But I thought that was odd when I dug up the information on him.
No, I've never heard this story before. So he discovered a type of earth battery. Is that it, or?
Yeah, he was working on an earth battery. You know, all of these people, you know, just sort of add to each other all the way down. You know, Tesla's in one of Stubblefield's pictures, in one of the newspaper pictures. At one of the events at Stubblefield where
maybe
he was.
Maybe you could help listeners to become more acquainted with this. First of all, an earth battery. Why don't we just explain briefly what an earth battery does or what it is?
It's basically dissimilar metals, you know, wound on a heavy core and put in the ground, and it's reacted upon galvanically, I would imagine, and that produces a current, and then you can operate little buzzers, relay mechanisms to then alter that and change it into an AC pulse type. And then if you run it through an inductor, you sort of get a sine wave out of it.
So in other words, you can drive two stakes in the ground and draw like 1.5 volts or something from them. Is that it?
Yeah, depending on your metals. Yeah, you could do that.
Or isn't it even possible to get such voltage out of a tree, a stake in a tree or something? Or
yeah, there's been research along those lines. There was a German fellow there. I mean, there's a ton of this stuff on the internet now. Back when I was getting into it, there was only one or two bulletin board systems, and you know, there wasn't much of
it. It was difficult to find this information.
I mean, now you can, you know, press of a button, and with high speed, you know, boom, you got it staring you in the face.
Yeah, it really is quite an interesting change in with regard to enlightening people about what's been done, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That all of a sudden now. All the people who are getting on board at this time because of the high cost of energy and the evidence of the damage it's done to the planet, they can immediately catch up to speed, something that you had to spend decades studying and scratching for. People,
yeah, they should appreciate that.
Yeah, it really is an advantage, isn't it?
Yeah, well, another one that you know, people want to look at whether or not this stuff was really there is... I happened upon it in an old bookstore. This was after I found the article in the 1965 Engineer's Handbook. I picked up a 1957 or 1958 congressional record at a used bookstore for 50 cents. When I opened it up, it opened up to the page where NASA is begging for money for their little... satellite project to try to keep up with the Russian Sputnik. And one of the senators or congressmen, whoever it was on there, was sort of laughing at him. You know, here you want us to spend all these millions of dollars. We're going to throw this little grapefruit up there, and it's, you know, going to send you back beeps, and then the battery's going to run out, and we've still got an umpteen million-dollar grapefruit up there that's useless. And the NASA people says, oh, no, the battery will never go dead. We've got a little heat engine on board that's going to keep that battery charged. But here, for years, they played that down, put people in prison and whatever, because a heat engine is impossible. But yet, for the government and NASA and the military, a heat engine is, you know,
doable
technology.
Yeah.
You know, in 50.
Isn't it interesting that you said that the congressional record highlights opened to that page the very thing that you had previously been interested in?
Yeah, you'll find out when you get into it. There are a lot of things that, you know, are uncanny in that sense. I mean, here you know, it's half the size of a, you know, it was an inch and a quarter thick, and
yeah.
you just flip it open and that's the page. You know, it's,
I've had some pretty funny things happen too, and you know that probably happens to researchers in all fields.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are many coincidences that cause people to uncover information, historical information, and so on. And it's what makes research enjoyable. I guess it would be boring if, in fact, you would have put that book back down probably, you know, if all it had been was politics.
True.
Because it touched on energy, that's where, you know. Yeah, it is pretty interesting. But let's go back then. So, because what actually started this whole thing was you're being asked to pay $80,000 to hook up electricity to your property.
Right.
And so at that time, you said that your wife...
Yeah, she'd heard on the radio that there were going to be a number, you know, probably 30 or 40 inventors or researchers at a Tesla conference in Colorado Springs.
Yeah. Okay, and this is back in the early 80s, is that right?
Early 90s, I think. That might have been 90, 91, somewhere in there.
Okay. And so you got the notion that this is the place where you needed to be.
Right. Well, they highlighted some of it on the radio, some of the things that were going to be there, and I said, oh, dog, you know, I didn't know this stuff existed. And so I, you know, got everything ready, packed up, and hit Colorado, and I was there for, you know, I guess the 3 days, you know, with my, you know, it was just a jaw-dropping experience. I didn't realize that there was so much work along so many different tangents of alternative energy. I mean, it was just mind-boggling. And I came away from there with I bought everything that they had, every video that they had made. And
back then there was no such thing as a DVD, right?
No, I came home with boxes, big boxes full of every book they had, and it was over $1,000 worth of books and videos.
Wow. So you were intensely interested in the subject, and you proved that by poring over these videos over and over again.
You know, the first thing I did when I got back, Joe Newman's little energy machine fascinated me. Wiseman was there with his vapor carburation, and then he had another a little...
You're referring to George Wiseman of Eagle Research?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Another little aside that he put on, I think the next day, was on... basically, you look at a stream and say it's a mile long. You can put a water wheel every 20, 30 feet and have that same water that turned the first one turn the second one and produce energy all along that thing.
That's interesting.
And he sort of drew on that with, you know, why... If you want to light that light bulb, why send energy through it and then go to ground? You know, why not create an artificial dipole and send that to something else and let it be used, and then go out of that to something else, and you know, and wear that energy out before you ever send it to ground.
Yeah.
And he had a little demo there with just, I mean, this is getting to your little pet peeve about people, you know, being able to just throw things together out of the auto parts or electronics store or hardware store or whatever. And all he had was a little bank of capacitors with a, I think he had a little wooden box with a bunch of switches mounted to it, and he had it loaded with capacitors and a little battery. And he had a little windshield washer pump, and he had some colored water so that you could see this water moving. And then he would charge up one bank of capacitors in parallel, and then he would switch them to series, and then they would put their power through that little windshield washer motor, pump water, showing that it was doing work, and then charge up these other bank of capacitors in parallel. And then he would reverse it, and he would put these that were parallel now in series and those others that were in series now in parallel, and he would just ping-pong the energy back and forth.
In other words, did he disconnect the battery, or?
Yeah, he just, once he did it, you know, ran the battery for the first time, and then it charged up the bank of capacitors on the other side in parallel. And then he went into his routine of going from parallel to series back and forth until it finally wore that energy out and it wouldn't turn the pump anymore. But, you got a number of iterations through that cycle, you know. And the normal way of handling is that you just shove it through one time and send it to ground. Boom, it's gone. You know, and here it put the idea in your head, you don't have to, that you can recycle energy before it goes to ground. You know, get some more work out of it.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it was.
And that's not even his field of expertise.
I don't know what his field was. You know, I mean, I just met him back then.
Yeah. His field of expertise has been combustion engines. And, of course, the Brown's gas welding.
Uh-huh.
Which evidently that also impressed you. Ewell Brown, did you actually meet Ewell Brown at that time? Or?
No, he was in San Diego trying to get his welders off the dock, and the U.S. government wouldn't let him.
Really?
Yeah.
Why was that?
He had a, because they use slave labor in China, or prison labor, I forget what it was. It was just a political deal.
In other words, they were Chinese built.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't building them in Australia then. He had them built in China.
Right.
Huh.
No, he had two. There were two or three groups there that were highlighting Ewell Brown's work. And then Ewell Brown, representative of Ewell's, was there to handle his part of it. But I think there were two other groups that were playing with that Brown's gas phenomenon that had their little demo set up. But I was like everybody else in school. You use the test tubes and a couple electrodes, and you get oxygen in this one and you get hydrogen in the other one, you know. And I'd never seen this where you just immerse the plates and throw the current in there and then let the gases mix. And the things that he could do with that just fascinated me. That was the first thing that I built when I got home. I emulated everything that I saw there within a month or so. And I got everything from the hardware store or auto parts or an electronics supply house. I mean, nothing was hard to get.
So you need a knockoff of a Ewell Brown electrolyzer.
All I did was go down and to the local hardware store and pick up stainless steel cover plates, and I had a milling machine in my garage, and I cut the notches out and made it similar. You know, the ones that they were using there had round, stamped out discs, but I just took mine and and milled it and then set them up parallel, you know, not series like the Rhodes or Bob Boyce's cell.
Yes.
And it produced, I put a little basketball filling needle on the end of it, and within 2 hours I was producing enough gas to weld, you know.
Wow.
Do micro welding with it.
So you made your torch.
Yeah.
And that's something.
And everything that they were showing there worked. And that's the thing that I didn't understand. You know, I thought, well, shoot, this stuff is going to beat me home. You know, this stuff, it's going to be on the shelves. I thought that EV Gray motor was a doable, that all of this stuff would have been there within another year or two. And here we are almost 20 years, and it's still not here. So I don't know what forces there are out here that can keep it from the market, but these were all doable deals. I mean, I could throw them together in a matter of hours, every one of the technologies they showed there. And they worked. You know, sure, they needed to be refined, but, I mean, the concept and the proof of concept works. I mean, it worked, and basically just like they said it would.
Yeah, well, it's all about where the real money is to support technology. Technology doesn't usually just happen because a few people realize that it's doable. It happens because people with money put their weight behind it. And even then, not all the inventions that someone puts money behind end up making it. Even if they're good inventions, the public has a mindset and they don't necessarily buy into it.
Yeah, we know who's got control of their minds.
Yeah.
I mean, it all it takes is a word or two to color something is disagreeable or horrendous or whatever, dangerous. I mean, the public doesn't do any research. They don't look into anything. Well, Dan Rather or whoever, you know, I don't know who the latest personalities are. I don't watch television, but...
Yeah, I couldn't tell you who the anchors are now either. But, you know, that reminds me of the movie, the documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car? Did you see that?
No, I don't go in for movies either.
Okay, well, it would be a worthy documentary to rent. I think you can rent it at one of the video stores. And it tells the story of the EV1 and how GM called them all back in and crushed them or shredded them. But they had to pretend that they were trying to promote the car, so they actually did a TV commercial for it. But the TV commercial was nothing like the commercials you see for their other products, which are always showing how glamorous and sporty the vehicle is and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
This ad was obviously seemingly deliberately designed to turn the public off so as to not want the electric car. And it showed a scene that one commentator said looked like Nuclear Winter. And they're describing the car in an eerie voice, and it has none of the sex appeal like they normally associate with their products. But that's similar to how you were just saying that the powers that be are capable, through the media machine, of making something look undesirable.
No, the same people own all these corporations also. Let's see, when was it? It was back in the mid-'80s. I used to deal with GM and Ford and all the big three in another industry that I was associated with. And I was talking to one of the engineers, and I was sort of riding him about the, they missed their chance on the Winkle engine or whatnot, because one of the Japanese companies picked it up and produced it there for a year or two, and they had the seal problem. You know, they used as much oil as they did gasoline, but it was a super efficient little engine, weight to horsepower ratio and everything. And he says, "I don't know what you're talking about. That's our engine." And he says, "We've already fixed that seal problem." And apparently he was on the project. I mean, he took offense at me talking about it. And he says, that thing's got well over 1 million miles on it and still has no wear. What we're trying to do now is get it to wear out within our warranty, you know, just outside of our warranty period. And then it'll be on the market. Until then, it's going to sit in our research facility.
Huh.
So it's...
So they had to work in the planned obsolescence.
Yeah, but, you know, he said, it's, you know, we've already got over 1,000,000 miles on that puppy.
And what kind of engine was this?
It's the Wankel.
Oh, the rotary engine.
The rotary engine. And what did they use? Ceramic and iron for the seals. They never wear, you know. It's a ceramic-coated engine also, you know, entered so that there's basically no wear to it. And that was the problem. You know, we've got it. Now that we fixed the problem, now we have to engineer it to fail after a certain point. And I was comparing notes with one of the neighbors one day. He was a fleet mechanic for one of the big beverage houses. They send them to school regularly to the to Ford and GM and whatnot for the latest products, so that they'll be able to service them. And GM was doing a show and tell on a lot of different technology, and this guy was, you know, well, why? When can I buy one? And this is not going to be made available to the public. And his reasoning, he says, the people aren't ready. And we're talking, yeah, about the same time, early, mid-80s, I guess. So there are industries out here sitting on things that will knock your socks off. And that's what I'm thinking is going to happen with the, you know, it may burst a few bubbles of people trying to get in on the ground floor on this situation that we're in now, maybe thinking that they're going to get in on the ground floor and run it up and sell out and make $1 zillion and whatnot. The only ones that I see making any money on this is the patent, the attorneys, you know, dealing with all of these patents, because most of this technology, is, like you found out, goes all the way back into the 1800s.
Yeah, which is really the beauty of it, because it's there for us to discover and perfect, you know, to modernize and utilize without having to worry about encroaching on someone's patent.
Right. That's the way I look at it anyway, because I don't even need their transistors and thyristor, whatever you want to use for switching and handling these different devices, if it's electrical. Tesla did it with a spark gap, water capacitors, and his specially built transformers. The governments or the big high energy physics labs around the world. I was doing some research in the last 6 months, and I came up with PDF documents on proposals for bids that for equipment that they needed. I thought it was just astounding that they still can't do any better than what Tesla came up with 110 years ago. They still spec that be made, that's a Tesla transformer design. Yeah, it may be bigger, but it's going to be built. And the picture that they show looks almost identical to what you would have seen in 1891, 2 or 3, when Tesla gave his seminars in America, in England and France, and then back over here in America again.
Wow. And what's the purpose of their research? What are they claiming to be trying to accomplish?
Well, they're trying to smack little particles together and see what they're made of, you know, high energy physics.
That's something.
Because it's still a theory. I mean, that made an impression on me years ago, that I picked up the latest, you know, $125 book from McGraw-Hill on electronics, and I had the mindset like everybody, you know, heck, they've had to invent everything by now. You know, there's nothing new. You know, it's all. As soon as I opened that book, it says the theory. This is the most current electronic text that I could find, and that word just jumped out at me. Theory. You still don't know what this stuff is? And, you know, that was back in the 60s.
Yeah, isn't that something?
And it made an impression. They don't know what this stuff is. And then, you know, my mind started working. When I was 19 years old, I was a foreman of an underground construction company. And we had made a deal with the gas company to come by and cut all of the gas lines so that we could just go by with the big excavators and just rip ground open and not worry about all of these lines, pulling them out of the house and the house blowing up. So they would go a little bit ahead of us, and they would dig down and clip these things off so that when we came to them, we could just rip them and keep going. And then as soon as we got it backfilled behind us, then they'd lay them back in. And there was an old man there, an old gray-headed fella. Here I am, 19, you know, I know everything. And I see him out there with these funny little coat hangers or whatever. It looked like, you know, just a bent piece of wire, you know, about 18 inches long and about a 6-inch handle, shaped like an L. And he's walking across these yards. And I'm making comments to the other people that, you know, there's something, you know, look at this guy, you know, I mean, he can't, nothing, that can't work. That's like dowsing or something, you know. That stuff went out in the dark ages, you know. That's just, I guess word might have got back to him because we'd advanced up another half a block or so, and I was concerned I didn't want to cut this people's sewer line out late in the day because we ran out of vitrified clay pipe to replace it. And we were taking forever trying to find it by hand with probes and whatnot, and he come up and he said, "What are you looking for?" And I, what's the holdup? And I said, "We're trying to find this sanitary line coming out of that residence." And he says, "Where's your coat hangers?" And I said, "Mine are in my closet where they belong, holding my clothes." And, you know, I was sarcastic with him, you know, because I'd seen him earlier and I was commenting about, you know, how foolish that is to walk around with those stupid little things and act like you're finding something. And he says, "Go in there and tell that householder to turn some water on in the bathtub or sink or whatever to have some water flowing through that line." I'm saying, "Oh, boy, you know. What has that got to do with the price of tea in China, you know?"
Yeah.
And here he goes, walking across perpendicular to where the line would go up to the house. And as he walked across, he looked, you know, and he saw the gas meter on the outside, and he told one of the guys to put a stake here, that's the gas line. Then he asked somebody to go in the basement and see where the water meter was. And when he found the next one, he looked back and he says, "Well, no, that the water meter's at the other side of the house, so this has got to be the sewer line." And I'm thinking, "Oh boy, you know." And sure enough, we dug down by hand. There it is, boom, you know. And it made an impression on me. So as soon as I got home, I didn't want to do it there at the job site because after all the razzing I was doing, you know, about this technique. So I waited till I got home. And I went to my closet and got my coat hangers. And I shaped them like his and whatnot because I knew where some big water, my 5-foot diameter puppies were. And I said, "Well, if them little, if it'll move a little bit there, these things ought to, you know, really move." And so I went across that puppy and they just lined right up, you know. And I'm thinking, "Well, that's some kind of magnetic effect." And then the more I thought about it, and I said, "Well, no, that can't be either, you know. He had brass rods. He had welding rods, brass brazing rods. So that, it can't be a magnetic component, but what makes these things line up?" And I found out it works with anything that's running. If it's static in the ground, you won't detect it. But if it's got a flow, you can detect it.
And so what do you attribute that to?
The coat hangers will line up to it. Now, go to MIT and go to their physics department, and they will enlighten you as to what that might be. But I still don't think they're calling it the ether or whatever. But
Oh, so they are actually subscribing to the notion that it does have an explanation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
as opposed to saying that it's hocus pocus and doesn't work.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a valid, I've struggled with it for 40 years. It's always been in the back of my head. What is it? Because I know it's not magnetic. You know, if current's running through something, then the magnetic component will be perpendicular to it. And the coat hangers, whether they be brass or actually soft iron or something, will line up parallel with this flow.
But they do have to be metal, or can it be some other material like wood or whatever?
I didn't. The only thing I've ever used was coat hangers or welding rods.
So the fact is that it is a type of metal.
Well, like you just mentioned, I haven't tried it. It could work with something else, but I know it works with the metal.
But in other words, it was a mind-opening experience because you realized that not everything that we discount as being ridiculous is necessarily ridiculous.
Right. Yeah. It's I've had a number of humbling experiences like that over my lifetime. So nowadays, when somebody approaches me with an idea, I do a lot of thinking and research before I. I'm not as brass as I used to be.
Yeah, well, there's more than one way to skin a cat, as they say, and that
True.
Certainly applies to alternative energy.
Now, that's what I notice out here with the common denominator on the ones that work is they are making efficient use of whatever people want to call it, dominant energy, zero-point ether, whatever. But they're making a more efficient use of it than the average bear. Because everything that we really use, even the conventional electricity, is really making use of the ether, and you can find that out at the same MIT site. All of the better universities are all in it. And it shocked me when I went there and found that they are attributing it to something outside the wires, that's what we're actually using. Not what's running in the wires. What's running in the wires is basically activation energy.
So this is like a great conspiracy theory that
mm-hmm.
there's actually there's two sets of books, and there's the set that people learn from, but if you look closer, you're saying that academia actually admits that there is another explanation that we don't want to confuse people with.
Well, this is a recent phenomenon. This isn't
all along, in other words. This is just a recent disclosure.
Right. This is only something that they've started doing in the last, I'd say, maybe 5-6 years.
And it's not well publicized.
Right. And the reason I came upon it by accident, I was on a site and people, because, you know, that when you take electronics courses and everything that you read, you know the electron moves at the speed of light. And that's what you're always taught. And on one of the lists, there were a couple guys arguing about the speed of an electron. And one of them said it's slower than a snail. and he said he gave a link to this MIT site. And so after I read their little comments back and forth, I went to MIT and I couldn't believe it. You know, they're not out openly saying, yeah, this is where we should have been 100 years ago. They're acting sort of like it's, you know, we're newly discovering this.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's good in itself too. I mean, it's
sure.
That means these young people are coming out with these mental pictures in their head now. And they'll be better able to manipulate this energy. And that's what's wrong with the. What I see a lot of people doing, they're not making efficient use of this stuff, and you need to approach it like go back and reread Tesla knew how to do it in a heartbeat. I mean, he just had such a clear mental picture of what he was dealing with. He could just twist up some wire and make what he needed to activate this, and just use a small amount of activation energy to get the big response. It's sort of like you know, the northwestern states, they out in the ski areas, they have a lot of snow on these mountains. It's just sitting there. And all it takes is a little activation energy. And, you know, hundreds and thousands of tons of that are going to come down with tremendous force and do a lot of damage, and all it takes is just a little activation energy.
Well, that's a good illustration.
And that's what we need to... Thank you.
That's the way we should view...
Well, that's the way we should approach... these, like whether it be electrolyzers or if you're trying to just do a direct energy conversion, you have to forget about this conventional way of doing it in at a snail's pace, so to speak. You've got to speed that thing up faster than what an electron can move, and then you will start getting these anomalous effects. Because that's really what's causing it anyway. It's just that, you know, they want to brute force it and send it to ground as quick as possible. And then, you know, you buy more.
Yeah. So similar to the gasoline consumption in inefficient systems that don't make full use of the fuel, you're saying that even in our use of electricity, we're basically doing the same thing. We've been taught to waste it. As opposed
right.
to...
Well, it's been legislated that we waste it. Like in the cars, I go back to where everybody had a big boat. You know, I had a big Mercury Brome. It was 85 pounds less than a town car, which is a big, heavy car. It had a 429 4-barrel on it, and I got 22, 23 miles to the gallon. And I floated around like on a magic carpet. I mean, you know, you never felt the road, you never heard anything. You know, it was a nice experience. Gas prices went up to 50 cents a gallon. I figured, oh, buddy, I got to get me a little fuel efficient car here. So I traded that in on a little Mercury Zephyr 6-cylinder, little tin can, didn't weigh half as much. And what do I get? I get 15 miles to the gallon. It's
how do you explain that? You go from a giant, heavy, big boat of a car, and you shrink down to a Zephyr, which I had one of those too, by the way, and you get fewer miles per gallon.
Yeah, but you can't touch the carburetor.
Advancing technology.
I could touch the carburetor in that earlier one. And then they'd already legislated, and a ton of tune-up shops just went out of business because they can't perform anymore. If we can't tweak that carburetor, we can't do anything for our customers. We can play with the timing and everything else, but until we can tweak that carburetor, you know, and I knew a number of shops that could. You would go in, and they would ask you, "How do you want your car to respond? What do you want us to do? Do you want mileage? Do you want pep? Do you want mileage and pep?" And I couldn't get over it. You know, they could sit there and tune those big cars and, you know, 20, 25 miles to the gallon. And, you know, we're talking about big, big, big block motors and you know, big four-barrel carburetors and still go cruising down the road at 22, 25 miles to the gallon. And then you get the one a few years later where they put the little stainless steel caps because they found out that people weren't paying attention to these little plastic limiting caps that they put on them. They would just take their side cutters and cut those off and go ahead and tweak that carburetor. And so they made the manufacturers hide them in places and then put stainless steel press-in covers over them so that you couldn't get to them. Readily. And they made it a law. I mean, it's federal law against the federal law to change anything on those vehicles. They don't belong to us anyway.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Well, as you say, that's apparently the wish of the powers that be, that we be persons who actually waste limited resources that are also polluting. And so the answer to not wasting is also the answer to pollution, right?
Right.
Because the pollution comes from wasting these resources.
And like a lot of your guests have mentioned, it, this stuff can be, you know, readily thrown together. I think you mentioned it last Saturday, that, you know, just get out and do something. A lot of this stuff can be thrown together fairly easily, you know, like you said, from Home Depot or any hardware store. These parts can be purchased and assembled in a matter of a day or so. And start getting the benefit of it, or at least helping clean things up a little bit. You're going to get some.
The example I think that we were using there at last Saturday's meeting in Louisville was making a hydrogen booster. It's maybe just the beginning, but it's a good start for someone who hasn't done anything.
Right.
To make their own alternative energy device that they can actually experience the results in saved money and reduced emissions.
And it's something that it's still available to do. And you don't have to, if you do it at that level, you don't have to worry about your car's computer system or anything else. You know, it will allow for that little bit. Now, once you start creating a larger amount, I mean, if you get into that game, then you are going to have to start modifying computer systems or tricking them anyway.
Yeah. Have you found easy ways to do that?
Well, I work with a number of different processors you could place them to where they would intercept the signals and change them to what needs to be sent to get the desired result.
And this is mostly oxygen sensor information, or?
No, the throttle body map, everything.
The map sensor?
Yeah, everything would have
now,
to be.
Okay, so you have a map sensor. That's a
mass airflow.
Manifold
pressure.
Air pressure, is that?
Yeah.
So there's a MAF and a MAP, isn't there?
Yeah.
And I guess different cars have different configurations for these things. There's not a universal signal that can be modified on all cars, is that it? Or
right.
It's brand specific or year.
Well, some of it is. Some of it is, you know, the governments try to legislate that, you know, it all be done to this standard, but even though it is, I'm talking to some, and you know they're mentioning that this one has their own set of codes. You know, it will do the standard, but then they go beyond. You know, just like Microsoft with theirs. You know, they'll come out with a browser that will take care of the standards, and then they will embellish it with these other things that people might want as eye candy or whatever.
Right.
So it is a little bit problematic. I mean, it's there by design. It's just to keep people from doing anything efficiently.
Yeah. Yeah, it does throw a monkey wrench into the home tinkerer's efforts to improve things.
But the common thing that I've seen in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, watching people not progress really that much. A lot of them are on the right track, and they do things like me. They'll find things out by accident, and they may not be reproducible, or for some reason they can't get that back. But one thing that helped me was looking at a water ram pump, and if you get a mental picture and understanding of that, you can pretty much manipulate the ether or whatever you want to call it.
So what is a water ram pump?
It's people that grew up in the country years ago. I guess it was invented back in the 1700s. It'll take a low flow of water, you know, just a couple feet of head, maybe 4 or 5 feet. And you run that down a nice straight pipe for maybe 40, 50 feet, and then you've got this basically a water hammer set up. at the end there, and it just passively sits there and works 24 hours a day.
Well, is this
and
one
it'll take that
has
low.
A check valve? Is that it?
Yeah, it's got a flat valve in it and a little air chamber to create an air hammer, and it makes use of the inertia of that water. As that water starts moving down that pipe, every one of those molecules starts moving, you know, for 50, 60 feet back, whatever length your pipe is. And now all of a sudden it's picking up enough velocity, it's got this little spring-loaded valve, and it'll pick up enough velocity, it'll grab it and slap it shut. And now you've got all of these other molecules for, you know, 60 feet back that come slapping everybody, you know, just like people trying to crowd out of one doorway in an emergency. And this other valve opens up into this where it's got a little air pocket. And this inertia will then transfer that energy into that air pocket, and then it will force a little bit of water up a pipe to
so
whatever elevation.
You're able to pump water.
Yeah. Without
anything.
Yeah, just a small flow of water. And it's the inertia that does it. Even though that's, you know, you look at it and say, oh, man, that's only 5 foot of head there. You know, what can I do with that? But you can push water with that 5 foot of head. You can push water 200 foot up a cliff. And then you use that gravity. The one that I was familiar with in Tennessee there, it fed 6 houses. And it just sat there 24 hours a day, just click, 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 click. Those little valves just clicking and relieving themselves. And it just pumped, filled the 1,000-gallon reservoir and then supplied 6 houses off of that 2 or 3 miles away. When you opened the hose, you didn't need a sprayer on the end. If you wanted to spray water 30 feet out of that hose, all you had to do was turn it on, and it had that much pressure.
Because of having been on a higher elevation.
Right.
But it was filled by a blurp from this, do you call it again, a water hammer?
Yeah, it's a water ram pump.
Water
ram. They call it a ram pump.
So you're saying that the principle of that is it exemplifies how free energy devices should be.
Right, because all you have to do is trick this stuff, and it will follow. When you go to MIT and read that section, this stuff will follow a moving charge. So you give it a blast, a super sharp pulse, and trick it into thinking, okay, we're going this way, and then you slap the door on it. Now you've got the inertia of this, the ether that's already filled that wire, so to speak, and it wants to go somewhere and do something. You know, so it's going to, you'll get a lot more out than what you put in, and that's where a lot of people are making their mistake when they're doing their readings as to what's coming in and what you're actually putting in and then what you're getting out of it.
The energy in and energy out equation.
Right, and it needs to be, I've done it myself in a number of different configurations, playing with hydroxy and playing with energy. And, I mean, when you start playing with this stuff and handling it that way, you'll notice things that they tell you can't happen. I mean, this stuff will take shortcuts. It will make superconductors out of anything. It will not follow the path of least resistance.
So,
or what I think is least resistance, anyway.
So, are you alluding to the fact that while experimenting with the use of, for instance, pulse current in producing hydrogen oxygen from water, you find an anomalous electricity generation also associated with the same pulsing technology? Is that?
Well, not out of, no, that's in a different, the electricity is in a different experiment, you know, to more of a direct conversion
setup,
to get to use it to get electrical energy, not just for the, you know, the hydroxy is one thing. And the other experiment is dealing with trying to shortcut, and I hear a lot of people wanting to talk, you know, wanting to use the hydroxy to run a generator to make electricity. And I don't think you need that step in there. If you want electricity, you can use a little bit of energy to create the electricity you need.
Without having to go to that extra step of running an internal combustion engine to generate it.
Right.
Okay, and that's where the question comes up, because I know Bob Boyce recently commented on the fact that his toroid setup that's used to drive the, I guess it's the power behind the pulse width modulator setup that he's created, he said that it's capable of actually producing electricity in excess of what it uses. And so I think that's pretty much the same point that you were making. If you can do that, why would you want to run an engine to produce electricity if that setup has been found to actually produce electricity?
Right. That was my thinking. That, you know, if you need the gas to run a ICE engine, then you know that's fine. But if you're going to do it just to run an internal combustion engine to generate electricity, I think that's a needless step.
So, in layman's terms, what is the effect of this toroid? Does that mean, is it really that? Is it a Tesla device? Is it?
Well, I don't. Bob's working with the toroid. When this stuff sort of caught my attention in the last 2 years, I kept digging, going back to Tesla. I read. I've got a number of his books or books about him and his papers, and I must have pored over them another half a dozen or dozen times. And it finally dawned on me, duh, he's not using AC electricity here, you know, dummy. He's trying to tell you what he's using. And it finally dawned on me what he was doing. And because he could take a bar of copper. Now, here you've got almost like a little school demo with a light bulb, showing them how a battery current works. I mean, he's using his disruptive discharge setup, but he ran it through a copper bar. Now, and he took a pigtail light, a light with pigtails on it, and that were maybe 4 foot apart, 4 inches apart, and he could place it on that bar. Now, we're talking a single conductor. We're not going from conductor to conductor. We're talking a single conductor in line, in series with it, and within 4 inches, it would light that light bulb. There's that much difference in potential in just 4 inches on that same bar. And that's because he was popping that thing faster than the electrons could move. So you end up creating all of these energy nodes, even though it should be just a single potential there, and that light should never work. And it won't work conventionally. But if you do the disruptive discharges like Tesla did, you can do the same thing. I mean, you'll see that, you know, that everything that you've learned, you have to sort of erase it and put some new mental pictures in there as to how things really work. And that's the energy you want to make use of. You are making use of it. Even your conventional electricity, you're really making use of the ether, but you need to make more efficient use of it, and Tesla was the only one that I found that could clear my thinking up on it. And then now that I look at other people's experiments and whatnot, I see a ton of them out here doing it. You know, John Bedini, Adams, I mean, just numbers of people are on the Nodland site. A lot of the research that he's doing, that replicating other people's work, it's all using the same. Some are just more efficient than others, but everything, everybody is making use of the ether, whether you're using conventional electricity or some of this alternative.
So after all the years that you've been researching this, do you find that there's signs of hope that more and more people are recognizing the validity of this approach?
You'd probably be better qualified to answer that than me. You've been out there drumming this up for a couple of years.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that I have an optimistic viewpoint with regard to what human society is going to do, because I think that's been a succession of blunders.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty obvious that human society in general is not going in a good direction. But as far as the enlightenment about the possibilities of alternative energy along the lines of what we've been discussing, I think the knowledge has certainly been more abundant. You know, it has spread quickly, and even this interview right here is an example of how enlightenment about these systems and how they work is available to people, whereas before it was much harder to dig up, as you found yourself. You had limited materials, and you had to pore over them over and over again because there really wasn't anything else that you had at your disposal, or you would have got it too.
All right.
Well, listen, we've already come to the end of our hour, but we haven't even touched on a lot of the things that we've talked about previously on the phone and whatnot. So perhaps we could do this again soon.
Yeah, that'd be all right.
And I do thank you for your time, because I'm sure that many people have benefited from your observations and your experience.
If not, maybe we can get some feedback and then clear up some of these other points.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, and look forward to talking with you in the future.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.